Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and when it comes to build-ups in wrestling, I like long story arcs, music videos, and Raven's analogy that is just like jerking off, except you don't have to change the channel when your kids walk in.
And I'm Old Man Jones, and at my age, the only build-up I care about relates to my blood pressure and cholesterol levels.
I'm Luke Edwards, and my build-up will be coming at the end of the episode in an incredible music video set to an anthology of George Formby songs. Oh yes. It's coming.
I'm G. John Chase, and apparently Sonny has been bad-mouthing the NXT Divas,
basically saying that women should not be wrestling and that they're simply eye candy.
Well, let me tell you something, Sonny. They don't just simply walk out, dance out, wink at the camera, and consume cocaine like it was sherbet dip.
So in future, why don't you keep your well-used hooter out of it? Cheers.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and my little brother tells me he's received an email from a certain listener this week who's claimed that I'm nothing more than a hipster. But let me make one thing perfectly clear. I'm not a hipster, I'm the guy hipsters wanna be. So get your facts straight, P. Brooks 78, you little cocksucker. This is the panel for the 47th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the best build-ups in wrestling history next.
What do you feel?
Hello everyone and welcome to the 47th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside Carl Jones.
Up, down, punk, gonna give it to you.
Kieran O'Rourke.
I'd like to thank McNeely's Beard Oil for sponsoring me on today's show.
G. John Chase.
Alrighty then.
And back with us, Luke Edwards.
I'm not willing to make any funny comments today. This is deadly serious business.
It certainly is, because after the last couple of podcasts, which have...
That's the most funniest thing you've ever said.
Sadly true.
Bordering on negativity for the most useless pay-per-view show we did a couple of weeks ago, we're back today, hopefully for a bit more of an upbeat, positive, nostalgic show, talking about the best build-ups in wrestling history. I'm personally fascinated by hype in professional wrestling. I think it's one of the things that really draws me to it, especially dreaming to it as a kid. And this is going to be a really fun show. So many great suggestions from you, the listeners, and you can listen to us in the archives if you're listening to us for the first time by going to squaredcirclegazette.podbean.com. Just a quick programming note for next week's show. We're going to be returning to our History of the Monday Night War timeline series, this time covering the second quarter of 1997 from April to the end of June. As always, we're going to have plenty of notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletters at the time. We usually wait a little bit longer since the last one to do the next installment, but there's so many notes that I really want to get to. I'm really excited to do it. So that is in store next week on the show. But as for this week, we asked you guys for your suggestions for the best build-ups in wrestling history. This can obviously pertain to whether it be build-up to a match, build-up to a show, build-up to a debut, however you want to interpret this. It's all about hype and which hype worked best for you and obviously worked best for us around the table. So we're going to kick it off now with Steve Bochenek from Baltimore, Maryland, who said, one of the ones we have to get to first, WrestleMania 3, the Piper's Pit segments were very well done to help sell the story of Hulk and Andre, culminating when Andre ripped off Hulk's crucifix. And Bad News Gertner from TPWW said this one: I started watching wrestling in late 86, early 87, and Hulk Hogan was my big idol. So Andre tore off Hogan's necklace on Piper's Pit. I could not wait to see my hero slam that big evil giant. We talked about this build-up in the Ranking the WrestleMania series, and I mentioned the build to this match specifically. It's been one of the reasons why I love that show in many ways. The opinion around the table very much was WrestleMania didn't truly find their footing until number 3 in terms of the overall presentation. It had been great build for the main event for WrestleMania 1, but for this one in particular, the idea of the dream match coming together so perfectly, and even though, you know, they didn't have to overdo it, there were so many great little segments. You know, we mentioned that, you know, the Piper's Pits there were tremendous. Jesse was awesome in this. I love this scene with bringing out the customized Andre the Giant championship belt in the event that Andre wins, because people don't think Hogan can beat the Giant, the supposedly undefeated for 20 years Andre the Giant. But yeah, this is one of my favourites too. A very good pick here in terms of great build-ups.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent choice to get the ball rolling. You've got bombastic Roddy Piper, who during one of the Piper's Pit segments, when the necklace is ripped off, just in his hushed monotone voice, "Hulk, you're bleeding."
Yeah.
The sort of the startling nature of the fact that Andre, who's been babyface for, you know, 307 years, you know, king of the battle royal, finally turns heel, aligns himself with Bobby Heenan.
What are you doing with him?
Yeah, it's all great. You know, Hogan hams it up, in a way that only Hogan could during that time.
Yeah, it's really good stuff. I'm really, yo, this was obviously before Piper became an inane dribbling moron that he's become apparently in recent times. But even then, just like the little touches of how it all began with like Hogan getting the trophy for being champion for 3 straight years, and Andre gets a smaller trophy for being undefeated for so long, and it's like Andre just walks off the set, and it's just great.
You're the first WrestleMania super fight kind of thing, and that's why it's kind of a mythical match, but it's the quintessential super fight build, really. You're inspiring superhero champ against maybe the one guy there's a question mark, can he beat? The simplicity and the pacing of it helps the build totally.
The only real physical contact is the shirt ripping. You get the contract signing, but that was actually comes across as a legitimate contract signing, not what we get these days. And I think with regards to that match in particular, sort of the final setting for it helps that sort of mythology, if you like, the fact that it's in such a massive arena, and you get the one picture of them stood sort of looking at each other, and you get Hogan as big as he is, the sort of diminutive Hogan looking up at Andre, and it all just meshes wonderfully.
And it's important to note that the WWE, the WWF, there's a lot of good hype, I'm sure, that we're going to come across over the episode. And a lot of the time, we remember fantastic hype for an end result that wasn't necessarily the greatest thing in the world. But this is an example of something that every step of the way is memorable. And certainly, for the sake of this episode, this is one of the ones I went to look at, thinking, I've mythologized this in my head. But no, as we say, it does stand up. It really does. There's a lot more subtlety to it than I think I was aware that wrestling was even doing at the time.
Heenan was great, too. Heenan deserves a great bit of credit for this in terms of great build, because Heenan was essential, pivotable, if you will.
Bobby Heenan at the press conference is just a masterclass in just male perfection, in just general, in just every life. Just like, it's just Hulk Hogan always looked up to Andre the Giant. Of course he is. He's 7 foot tall. Just lines like that. It's just always great. I think the shirt tear was the only thing that was really needed, because it was all about the symbolism, whether it was intentional or not, like ripping off the cross as well, which is just kind of like, sort of evil bastard rips off the cross. It's like,
not it's, Jesus.
It's, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hogan's one
it's,
thing.
It's exactly. It's kind of like it's a ripping off of faith, isn't it? It's a ripping off of faith. It's ripping off faith in Hogan, and this as him as a person. What this helps us as well is the fact that, as we said, alluded to, it wasn't the week in week out breakneck speed got to fill 3 hours of TV writing. So there's we're talking about like a few select moments. But the subtlety and the emphasis put on those moments by the key supporting players as well, they still stand out. And it's like, whereas today you've got, if you have a month's build, it's like you can't remember what happened on week one, but by the time the match comes around. So
whilst the build-up to the main event of WrestleMania 3 was really great and was obviously what sold the show, but I thought the build-up to the Steamboat Savage was pretty good as well, with the whole attacking with the ring bell and damaging Steamboat's throat. Steamboat's away for ages.
Although the vignettes of Steamboat learning to talk again probably wouldn't age well.
Well, yeah, probably not. Yeah,
they but, don't.
But and the dramatic return and so on. That had its good build as well. So it wasn't just with Hogan Andre. I think it was also, to a less extent, Savage and Steamboat as well.
Don't sleep on Piper Adonis either. Piper Adonis was very well built up with the whole Flower Shop Piper's Pit thing for months and months and months. And it's like, I think they started that in like September, October time the year before. So
something like that. And it's worth remembering in regards to that match, the tag of it being Piper's retirement match.
Yeah.
We can make insert joke here about retirement in pro wrestling, but that played a significant part in it.
So I was going to say, what you mentioned earlier on, Kieran, about making those key moments count, 10 of the times, a lot of that stuff when you watch WrestleMania 3 back, it really is only about one thing that happened. Jake Honky, the guitar shot, was the only build-up to that match, but it's all they needed because they just replayed it again and again and again.
It's exactly what I was going to say. It's kind of, for me, it's about the emphasis on the premise of the build, the premise behind the fight, behind the match. And I think that's what will, I think for me, that's what really comes through with all these, is it doesn't matter whether it's a 2-week build in some cases or a year long build, because there are year long builds which don't resonate as much. It's that be able to emphasize the premise of the fight, which then really captivates the imagination.
Absolutely. Although on the subject of duration with these feuds, Air Raid from the UK Fan Forum says, for me, one of the best builds ever, which might be slept on somewhat these days, was for Taz versus Sabu from Barely Legal. The storyline was an early example of the worked shoot, which was actually very effective, unlike many that would follow, as it was entirely believable that Taz would be pissed off both at then his tag team partner leaving him in the lurch, and Sabu, at the company for bringing him back. The reinvention of Taz after his return from injury created a very credible and popular character, and it was also a credit to Sabu that he managed to stay so popular during the 12 months of a apparently ignoring the challenges from Taz, which might have weakened other wrestlers. After 12 months of gentle simmering, the eventual confrontation at November to November 96 was positively nuclear, and only then did the proper build begin. The patience in gradually building the ECW fans' desire, almost need, to see this match was absolutely masterful, and made it the only candidate to headline Barely Legal. For that fan base, I'd nominate Sabu Taz as the greatest bit of promotion Paul Heyman ever managed for a headline match that made you sit up and think, this is a main event. And Seth82 from TPWW forums also says this one: the way ECW built up Taz and Sabu's feud was amazing. You really believe these two hated each other. I'm a big fan of this one too. I thought this was where, during what I feel is ECW's best year of television, which is the kind of, you know, mid-95, mid-96 range, I love what they're doing with Taz and Sabu here. The promos with Alfonso at the camera while Taz is doing step-ups, looking at a Sabu t-shirt. I love the little intricate details of this one, where things like Rob Van Dam attacking Sabu's neck, and then it being you know, coming out later on that he got the tip to go after the certain part of the neck from Bill Alfonso, who got it from Taz. These little details, I thought it was really cleverly done. Great job of building anticipation for this one for a long time.
Taz in particular to me is excellent in this period, because obviously he very much believed in the character himself. He sort of, yeah, he was eat, sleep and breathing the character, so it gives you that authenticity to the build. And again, it plays into a similar sense of what we talked about just with the Mania 3 card, that less is more and the lack of interaction between the two central characters. For the longest time, the build revolves around Taz calling Sabu out, wrestling other people and calling them Sabu. You mentioned the step-ups to the Sabu t-shirt. And then you get nothing until November to remember, when the lights go out. Lights come back on, Sabu and Taz are in the ring, they charge, and the lights go out again. So, you know, by that point, the lack of contact just has the ECW fans absolutely salivating to see the match take place.
The lights-off gimmick was, you know, it's kind of Heyman being dastardly brilliant at that. You think, oh, wow, now we're going to get something.
No.
You've got to wait a bit more. But, you know, it's also a testament that with any of these long feuds, to keep the angle, the anticipation of the rivalry fresh without contact, which as we get closer to the modern age, it gets harder and harder. And you know, compared to something like, for example, Cena and Rock, when it was just kind of the polar opposite, really. When it's, yeah, you announce it a year in advance, but it doesn't progress. There's no building of anticipation, and then you get to the final, and it's you know, it's kind of a standard fair build, really. It's just a match that happens to be announced a year in advance, which is totally different to the build and anticipation of when a two guys can actually fight. So,
yeah, interesting. I do like the build from Roxina, to be quite honest. I thought that was on the better builds in quite some time.
Maybe it's just me being disappointed because of in principle, when you think you've got a year to build these two, a lot of it was wasted time.
It didn't
the lights off Sabu Taz gimmick, like, it's a pinch of the drama, but there was none of that in the middle of Cena Rock, really. It was a more of a conventional modern build, just happens to be with the year advancing.
I agree with your general sentiments when it comes to Rock Cena. I do think there's a slight caveat to that, though. Sabu and Taz was a long build, but we didn't initially know when the match was going to happen, so that leads to the anticipation. I don't want to jump the gun at all, because I think this may get referenced later on, but
go ahead.
Sting Hogan.
That's the next one on the list.
Because whilst you know the match is going to happen, you don't know when, so you are waiting to get down the line, whereas the Rock Cena one is obviously different. The fact that they've announced that date, to me, it takes away a little bit of that anticipation.
Announcing the date rather than building the suspension of when's it going to happen, it's a completely different dynamic. The one thing I'll say about Cena and Rock, though, and I don't want to knock it, I mean, I already did. Yeah. Well. Whatever. I like to, you know, cover both angles.
Ride that fence.
Yeah. But it's a set date, so it's like a box. It's like Mayweather Pacquiao or McGregor Aldo. You know where you're going, so you can probably more promos, more your press conferences, your world tours, your things like this to build anticipation over a course of time. But for me, I just thought they did. It was as Cotter said, lacklustre, and they kind of dropped the ball in that respect.
But I think with ECW, with the an element of uniqueness to the crowd as well, is and Paul Heyman's booking, is the ability with even a long feud to keep that fever pitch at that top point, that high level, for a sustained period of time by the booking. Because feuds tend to, you know, they ebb and flow in the level of interest, especially in longer feuds. And when you've got something like Rock Cena, you know that you've got to aim to get it at the top fever pitch at a particular date. And if you've got a year ahead of you, it's going to ebb and flow a lot. And I think there's almost too much of a feeling of holding back too much until that last moment. Whereas you can judge the reaction and flow with it, and some of the greatest feuds react to that as it goes. It's not all 100% in advance. It reacts and plays off what the crowd respond.
The styles as well, I think, was a key thing, with just like Sabu being this kind of crazy, you know, hardcore wrestler flying through tables, whilst you know Taz is just suplexing the shit out of people. And I think it was just that thing of like, it was more like Sabu had been built up to this high plane of just where he is, and it's like now Taz is not the Taz maniac anymore. He's got a serious gimmick, and it's like, okay, I believed in the Taz gimmick probably as much as Taz himself did. I thought that this little fucking pudgy midget could fuck anyone up.
Going to the next one here, Aerie from the UK fan from, as Carl alluded to, you'll also be inundated with nominations for Hogan Sting from Starrcade 97 for obvious reasons. While a great proportion of the reason we were clamoring to see this match was to simply see the Crow Sting finally wrestle, it can't be understated what an effective job they did of ensuring we all hated Hollywood and wanted to see the Stinger knock his block off. Hogan was smug to the point of nausea, and the very best of the cheating weasel coward heel champion, fucking over the good guys and honkying his way out of title defences. The interactions between the two en route, while limited, were always very entertaining, with Sting dropping in from the ceiling, or that great angle where Sting disguised himself as an imposter so he could scorpion death drop Bischoff and watch Hogan shit his pants. While it might be to the detriment of the build that the result was never in doubt, I can't deny that for matches where I experienced the build up as it happens, Sting Hogan was the match I look forward to seeing the most. And Yashamaga from WrestlingForum.com also says, Sting Hogan by a country mile. This is the feud that made me a wrestling fan. Watching Sting come down from the rafters and being the invincible avenger of WCW against the evil NWO and taking out 10-12 guys by himself really captivated my 7-year-old mind. Sting has been my favourite ever since then. It didn't hurt that I was a huge mark for the Crow film as well. Several other people mentioned this one as well, not to keep plugging the History of Monday Night War timeline. They originally have Sting come back at Uncensored in 97 and changed their mind, and then decided, we can hold this off for 9 more months, because they were doing it as they went, similar to what you said, Luke, with Sabu Taz listening to the crowd and seeing how much mileage they could get out of it. This is a really good one. What's actually quite interesting, looking back, and maybe this is one of those things that I just wasn't really all that aware of at the time, but Hogan did a lot of jobs in 97. Like, he lost to, like, Luger at Bash at the Beach. He got beat on Nitro twice by Luger. Two pay-per-views prior to Sting. He loses to Piper in the cage at Halloween Havoc, which is quite surprising to me.
It is quite remarkable that Bischoff had the patience to hold off on that match, considering the nature of the business at the time and just the general way in which Bischoff had booked in WCW. And I'm probably going to come across as a bit of a hipster here. I don't know. We'll see. There are bits of it that I really like. Yeah, the uncensored bit is fantastic.
Oh yeah, it's awesome.
Where the crowd are shitting their pants because Sting's going ballistic on the NWO. An almost forgotten little tidbit is at the final Clash of Champions, where they're doing the is it Hogan's birthday? Or is it the NWO 1 year anniversary? I forget what the celebration is in AEW, but it's but there's a celebration in the ring. And the lights dimmer, and you have Sting's music playing, and then he just appears in the rafters with the Crow.
Oh,
and
yeah!
That's
oh,
how,
this
and that's
is,
how
yeah.
the show ends.
Well, hang on a second, I want to ask. No. Isn't this when the Vulture flies to the ring?
Yeah, it ends up in the ring on the rope.
Yeah, yeah, and they fucking up,
all,
right?
And they're all sort of wary of it, just sort of staring, and then that's how the show ends.
Well, that was actually fucked up. I was reading about this again and preparing them at the next couple of Monday Night War timelines. Apparently what was supposed to happen was that Crow had like a rolled up piece of paper in its claw, it was Talon, I guess it would be, I don't know, that said Hogan's soul. And the idea was going to be that, you know, they ask, what's it going to take, you know, what do you want to come back to wrestle? And the bird was going to fly down, they read the note. Instead, the note falls out of the bird's hand as it's flying, so the bird's just standing there on the rope, and everyone's trying not to laugh at the end of the show. So again, probably not the best thing to describe how good this build was, but this build was really good.
I still, okay, yes.
You don't know that, though, watching it.
You don't know that, and I didn't know that till you just told me. So, but I still think the optics hold up.
We can't unsee it.
Yeah.
I just remember thinking, I really hope that bird shits on Hogan's head. That would have been fucking amazing. Yeah. But so he's supposed to have a note in his talon? Or?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would look terrible on TV anyway. You're going to have like a big close-up on the little note that you can't actually read. Yeah, that would have been stupid anyway.
But I think there is actually a bit too much in this build for my liking. In terms of repetition, there's too many times Sting comes from the rafters. They mentioned the 1 week there where he gives Bischoff the Scorpion Death Drop. Well, 2 weeks later, for some reason, he appears with Bischoff and then shoves the T-shirt in his mouth. And yeah. whilst they do a very good job of holding off on the actual match, I think there are elements to the build that I'm not necessarily the biggest fan of.
My kind of gut feeling on this feud is, you look at the NWO, how that was used. It was for a long time. It was the same concept, week in, week out. They come in, they destroy, they rule. Next week, rinse, repeat. It's the same thing over and over again. I think it's Bischoff's MO. He got the Sting thing. He's always in the rafters, and then he's the guy, and they just rinse, repeat, and he does it for week after week. I mean, rightfully so, because of the buy rate, because it works.
I was going to say, ultimately, all this criticism.
I'm not
best buy rate in the history of WCW.
Yeah,
so.
I don't want to knock it in that respect. I just think maybe Bischoff, you know, it was a lucky time in his life, and it seems that the formula worked. I think it wasn't as consciously well constructed as maybe he likes to propagate. That's just my gut feeling. But no, absolutely, the hold off. It's Sting, the only guy getting shine on the NWO, proper shine, really helped and really stood out. He's the guy who can actually beat these guys all on his own rather than getting his ass kicked. It's just a shame they fucked up the actual match itself.
So bad, yeah.
Killed All Heat, which, I don't know, that's a conspiracy. Kieran's conspiracy corner theory. Nick Patrick had the word in his ear, don't do the slow count. Yeah. Do normal, so, yeah.
No doubt.
Whilst I can't argue with the success of the build, and I understand why a lot of people would put the build in quite a high regard, it's that repetitive nature of it to me, which is why I don't necessarily put it as high up as some others would.
Again, we said before about the Hogan Andre thing. It's the one thing, and it's that one premise that stands out of the ripping the chain, for example. And I think it's a similar thing with Sting Hogan, but maybe it's just the change in the TV dynamic that you have got it week in, week out.
Yeah, totally.
And you have to be a bit repetitive to get to have the premise remain
drilled in your head.
Exactly.
Because
things
are moving so fast, and it would have been very easy for things to be lost in the shuffle.
It's just different landscapes, different formats of telling the story, I guess.
I think the original the poster had another really good point of it as well, which is how much they had to work with, because you take the return of a character in a different form to what we've seen him before, going and putting him straight into a feud with somebody, straight into a match, I should say, straight towards this match with someone the crowd wants to be beaten up. I mean, you can contrast it well with Sting's WWE debut, which was a character that everyone wanted to see. And then you realise he's going to fight Triple H, and you go, oh, well, that's not really the match anyone was looking forward to.
No.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that it's people wanted to see Sting Taker, and you could easily do a year's build with neither guy on a full-time contract and could have done something amazing there. And it shows with the Sting Hogan, which is that you had a match that people were going to want to see. That was, of all the people, if Sting had reappeared and went after Lex Luger, not the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's picking the target and really going with it.
A lot of the charm of what you just said there, Luke, with this feud was, at first when J.J. Dillon's trying to get Sting to sign the contract, and he's offering him guys like Kurt Hennig, and Sting says no. He's offering him guys higher up the food chain, and he's like, no, 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 else it's going to lead to the bird and the Hogan challenge. Which one? But anyway, move along now to one that's actually very, very interesting, I think. There might be some polarising views on this. Roll the Dice from the UK Fan Forum says, Rock Austin WrestleMania 17. The sit-down interview with JR was brilliant and will always be remembered, as well as the My Way Limp Bizkit video. Vito Cruz from TBWW also says, for video packages, the My Way one for the Rock Austin WrestleMania 17 was the best by a country mile, in my opinion, and that's saying something, because the WWE have done some phenomenal video packages over the years. Malico from TBWW also says, the Rock vs. Austin at 17 felt like the biggest match of all time, time during the build-up. It was probably the peak time for the business as a whole too, with everything converging to that pay-per-view and that match. It felt monumental, so I would go for that. And of course, the build itself and that video package. Johnny Vegas from TPWW also joins in here. Definitely Rock versus Austin at Mania 17. I can still hear Howard Finkel in my head introducing it. The crazy difference about then and today's booking is that Rock and Austin feuded on multiple occasions before that match, and not once did it feel overdone. It's almost like Ali Frazier. Today, things need to be booked to make sense again, not just because it's something to do. It's an interesting one here, because I can certainly see why he said it, but for me, if you look at the bullet points, the bit by bit by bit, I don't consider this one of the best built up matches of all time.
Rock didn't get the title back until like No Way Out, when he beat Angle, so you kind of have about a month at best of build. There was something to do with Deborah involved as well.
Vince made Deborah the Rock's manager, and it was known at the time that Deborah and Austin were married.
I actually think that this is almost like a game of two halves, really, when it comes to this build. It wasn't until like those two moments where it was like the My Way video and the sit down interview that for me really sold it. Up until then, it was just like it felt very rushed. That's the kind of thing we've talked about duration, and we probably will constantly talk about duration during the podcast. It doesn't have to be over a long period of time for it to work. But for me, when you're booking Rock and Austin again, 1 month worth of build, I don't think is enough.
Well, they had about 6 weeks between No Way Out and WrestleMania that year, being in early April. But there'd been a bit more to it, that there had been foreshadowing. You had it with the Hell in a Cell, because they'd had interaction and they'd had a standoff. You had it at the Royal Rumble in particular, where they're in opposite corners and they fix eyes on each other. And then you have
and rise together.
Yeah, so that there were tasters there. There were little teasers there along the way.
And to the credit, every time they did one of those, it always felt like, God damn, if they ever do this match, if they do it at WrestleMania, this is going to be huge.
Yeah, it always felt like a big deal. Purely because of the two personalities, you could have literally just announced the match, as you say, and that in itself would have gone two-thirds of the way to a build. The My Way music video is incredibly well done, and you know, and as much as we can knock WWE for a lot of things, their production, in particular during that period with video packages and things, was always top-notch. The Deborah stuff I really didn't like. That was a real contrived element to it. I'd be curious to know everyone else around the table's view on this sit-down interview, because I've heard a lot of contrasting views on this, and I'm not actually the biggest fan of it.
Really?
I don't think The Rock comes off particularly well in it at all.
I think Rock comes off like an asshole in it, to be honest.
That's what I mean, and he's not supposed to come across as an asshole.
No.
It, you know, the story told itself. It was Austin versus Rock. Austin's beaten him before, Austin was the man, but Rock's now coming to his own. It seemed, when they first put the match together and they introduced Deborah, it was almost like they're going out of their way to take the most natural elements that make this match unbelievably massive. Muddy the waters and dilute,
and you're making it about Jeff Jarrett's manager.
Yeah, you're just completely diluting the match, and then thankfully they got away from Deborah and they did the interview, which at least focused, put the focus back on the two guys. And Austin's tendency, like, you know, that you think I'm not coming back for anything else other than to win, and just again that really did pinch the feud and the story. And then obviously the My Way video really did, you know, peak it at the right time. By the time show comes around, they'd absolutely got there, but it was almost like they just. Put obstacles in their own way to telling this story that was the most natural story for them to tell. And everyone knew where it was. Everyone knew where the match was coming from, where the guys were coming from, the history between the guys. Just let them do their thing and just tell the natural story that was there to be told. And when they did that, it was great. And you know, the music video it personifies that. So they got there eventually. It was fantastic. You can't not that. It did feel like the biggest thing of all time.
Yeah, the great scene, which we haven't mentioned yet, where Austin has, you know, they're toasting each other in the ring, but it's with that kind of thread of malice as they're doing it, and it ends up in the big pull apart in the big fist fight. Great stuff in parts, but I think again, symbolic almost of the modern era, especially with this getting so much positive feedback, it's like people cherry picking the good and kind of ignoring the bad, but because the good was so good, they could get into it.
It's another one in the Hogan Andre build, which is the mythology of what that match was, and the match itself was fantastic, and people just assume the build was great because the only thing you do is you pop on YouTube and you watch that video. and you know what, I might just do that right now. I'm gonna leave you guys to it.
Very good point. Yeah, I do love the part where I wonder how much Austin liked the bill with Deborah, because in that sit-down promo that you mentioned, I do love when he's just like, let's just take Deborah out of the equation. Yeah, she's a non-factor.
She's a non-factor.
She's your fucking wife. Speaking of music videos, Harmonic Generator from the UK Fan Forum says, I really like the build-up to the NWO's WWE debut. It was all tied into the Vince Ric Flair co-owner storyline, and Flair had just beaten Vince at the Rumble. Vince went totally off the deep end and had a meltdown on SmackDown, ending with the revelation he was bringing in the poison that was the NWO to regain control. As someone who hadn't experienced years of NWO by watching WCW, Vince really sold them to the likes of me as a mega, mega threat. This was bad news. Flair's response included what is still, to me, the greatest video the WWF has ever done, the Lonely Road of Faith video. Anyway, it's all built and built to No Way Out, which I don't remember being a particularly good show. I suppose because a lot of the focus was on three guys who weren't even going to be wrestling, and then of course the actual NWO return turned out to be not good at all. But the build-up, just for that video, it was a great build.
Yeah, I actually share the same sentiments as the chap there, because I remember when the whole angle where Vince is black and white, and Vince is like looking into the mirror or something like that, or the camera's looking into his reflection from the mirror.
Yeah,
like,
you don't know who he's talking to.
Yeah, you don't know who he's talking to, and he's ranting and raving, which I imagine is actually what he's like in real life. And then at the very end, he turns the chair around, and like, you see the reflection of NWO and so on.
In Tippex.
Yeah, in Tippex.
In fucking Tippex. It was such a great thing, and it turned around, it was like slightly scruffy.
Also, was what we were looking at when he says NWO, was that in the reflection in the mirror?
Yes. So somebody must have done it.
So he must have wrote it around backwards, which is a bit retarded. I remember that, and I'm just being really excited at the time, because with the emailer, I hadn't experienced years and years of NWO, because I started watching WCW in 99. Yeah. And so I missed all the convoluted, like, the multiple gangs of NWO. So all I knew was, like, NWO, the biggest angle in WCW history, and now it's in WWE, and Vince McMahon surely can't fuck this up.
Vince can't. I thought Vince was going to fuck things up.
He did do such a good job with the invasion, after all.
Yeah, I know. I should have learned. I should have learned. Wow, this invasion angle sucks. Next day, Ric Flair turns up. Brilliant. That could have, yeah, you know, we could have needed someone to legitimize the invasion angle, like, you know, like Ric Flair. But yeah, it's just, I remember the build right up until that point, and just thinking, being really excited to see the NWO here. And then, yeah, it's just like, straight away at No Way Out, they're like the first people that come out, and it's just like, you know, Hogan.
Opening promo as everyone else.
It does the same as everyone else, and Scott Hall doesn't look like Razor Ramon anymore. He just looks like
Rick Wagner.
he just looks atrocious. He just looks like my armpit. You know, it's just horrible.
And Jimmy Nail.
Jimmy Nail.
I was very hyped for the idea of them coming in. I don't know how anybody else feels around the table about what you just mentioned, the Vince promo with the spin around. I remember reading the SmackDown spoilers for this great introduction. Oh my god, they're going to bring in the NWO. How are they going to do this? And then reading the results and saying, they wrote the fucking name on the back of a chair. And that's it for the NWO. Like, come on.
Well, unlike the emailer and unlike G, I did have those years of negative reinforcement of what the NWO became. And I absolutely hated this concept. I hated the idea of bringing them back. I hated Vince's promo on SmackDown and the spinning around in the chair. The only good thing that came out of it was that Lonely Road of Faith video.
Yeah.
The rest of it is absolute garbage. And you can see that, by the way, that the angle is quickly dropped within the space of 3 months.
It was quite awful. Talking about the build here, Carl.
I was mixed emotions at the time. You know, in terms of a guy who likes to, like, new guys, new build, freshness, it was, oh god, it's gonna go, it's a back step. But at the same time, there's the mark element, like, wow, let's see what they can do with
it.
But then, like, you, it's like, that's how they introduce Vince. It's just Vince. It shouldn't be Vince. It should
if they're not invading, what's the
point? Exactly. It just didn't work for me. Despite the moments of positivity that come out of it, it was a disappointment for me.
After the Lonely Road of Faith video, which was excellent, they did the thing where Vince is in the ring and said, doesn't matter, because these men are coming, and he shows up on the video wall, and you get to see for the first time Hogan, Hall, and Nash just posing, and the crowd's just going crazy, like, this is gonna be great, and then
Old Man Jones is sipping his Carlsberg. I told you!
But it's just the whole premise behind it. You know, I'm bringing the NWO in to kill my own creation. Yeah. You know, we talk about the contrived nature of things. It doesn't get more contrived than that, surely.
Not to be devil's advocate. Go on. But, no, I actually, I like the idea. I don't think it necessarily was done to its best potential. But I do like the idea of the whole I'm just going to burn it down kind of thing. And Vince, you know, gave a reasonably good portrayal of the psychotic snap from an overdone cartoonish wrestling standpoint, which is how he does everything.
Gulp of doom.
Yeah, well, basically, yes. And it was a slightly different take on Vince. I quite enjoyed it at the time, but as I say, that Tippex NWO on the chair was just so fucking amateur.
It just reminded me of WrestleMania 2000, where it's like a McMahon has to be behind everything.
Yeah.
And that is not...
Give the Divas a chance.
Yeah. And that was just... It just epitomised the NWO. So yeah, it's going to be the edgy NWO in the controlled McMahon environment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, cack. Suplex Sinner from the UK Fan Forum says, the WrestleMania 25 build to Triple H versus Randy Orton has to be one of the most compelling of recent wrestling history. The build made it feel like a real blood feud. The angle with Steph selling the RKO like death. Triple H screaming at Orton was incredible. It was the first time in years I actually thought, shit, did that really happen? Even the hokey Triple H going to Orton's house was fun because it felt important. Both did well building the match, even if it was perhaps 2 weeks too long. And it was the first main event in 7 years that I actually wanted to see and cared about the result. Brutus is not my name from WrestlingForum.com. Also says this one, and says Randy destroyed each member of the McMahon family. He punted Vince in the head, kissed Steph on the lips in front of Triple H, and punted Shane in the head at No Way Out. Randy was booked as an unstoppable monster that didn't care. Triple H was also booked like a monster, like chasing a legacy through the backstage area and even going as far as trespassing into Randy's house, which caused him to be arrested. I honestly loved the build-up. The match was garbage.
What you guys at home didn't see there is when the feud just got brought up, we had Carl, Kieran, and myself looking at each other going, what the fuck, I can't remember any of this. And then we just clicked on that home invasion thing. And that fucking home invasion. Some of the bits were quite nice. A fucking punt that McMahon took was ridiculously brutal.
To start it all.
Yeah, I mean, that was something very special. But, you see, I've always got that problem, which I've mentioned on the podcast before, is I don't like people who I assume in real life are assholes. And I kind of assume that both of these people in real life are assholes. It's two assholes beating each other up. Whoever wins, whoever loses, we all win. But that fucking house invasion was so fucking bad. Wasn't that the one with Orton's wife or Orton's girl? And it wasn't, or it was...
It wasn't, and then they piped in a scream,
that's
if I remember
it.
Right.
It was... Jesus, forgive... Pillman and a gun would work out better in this situation.
Yeah, I'm glad you referenced that one. Yeah, the whole hammer coming through the door, like it's something out of Shining. And Austin Pillman with the gun, this is not. You know, that had a sense of... You know, it was portrayed in a very, very realistic sense. This was portrayed as something out of some crappy horror film with the man trying to burst into the house. Yes, the punt on Vince was good. The draping DDT on Stephanie was good. No one really cares about what happened to Shane. He's not even mentioned by the company anymore, so there you go. But the home invasion just completely ruins it all for me. Absolutely ruins it all. And because it's Triple H and Orton, and we've seen this story play out before, and you know how it's going to play out again. That really does that, and to a large extent, takes away any enjoyment I could have from the build.
Badass Shane McMahon defending the family.
Yes, it
fuck
was.
That
to me, more than the home invasion, that flattened this out so much because it was, and to the point where they had to do. Oh, this is the way that it went, was they did the old fucking hamster cheeks, comes down, beats the shit out of Randy Orton.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Orton beats him, after going 50-50 at No Way Out, if I recall correctly. Then he does the RKO on Steph. Triple H comes out and does the whole angry face thing, which is really cool. And that does, like, this is going to be good. Home invasion the next week completely deflates it, and they have to do the second one then, where Triple H is handcuffed, he DDTs Steph, and then kisses her unconscious body. And that was a great angle.
That was a great angle, yeah. But again, yeah, punctuated with such crap.
Is this one of these ones again? They're taking the individual elements and the fond individual memories are classing as a great build up in their minds, you think? Or
yeah, possibly, but I just think the way it kind of flips back and forth between absolute shit and moments of greatness. And I think it was more for me, it was the heat on Orton as well. It was whenever he got some, he did the Vince thing, but then he was taken over Shane. Yeah. Gets him on Steph, and he's taken away by the shit home invasion. So it negates, even though there's a couple of really good elements overall, by the time the match comes around, I wasn't looking forward to it.
And I don't mind Shane O'Mac. I don't mind if he's used in certain ways when he's been like the douchebag heel, but being as the brave babyface savior is just a step too far.
But he's defended the McMahon family against people like Test and Steve Blackman
Anyone
in the past.
Can beat Test or Steve Blackman. I remember Royal Rumble. Orton's being a douchebag. He's doing this Viper gimmick now. He does this thing where he mocks the shit out of Steph. She slaps him, and then he kind of confronts her about it, and Vince just does the thing of like you apologize to her for your comments, and he ends up attacking Vince. I just remember watching it, and at that time Orton did, there was a little few things that Orton did was really great, where he's like he sees all round to go and he hits a punt kick. As soon as he does it, he fucking regrets it because he's just realized what he's done. That they put a bounty on him at the Rumble, and he doesn't come out till I think somewhere in the early 20s of the Rumble, and when he does come out, the pop is freaking huge. It's not a heel like, oh, this guy's an asshole. It was a fucking pop. I was watching him thinking like Orton's going to be the new babyface, because when you're looking at how that angle started, Orton wasn't the heel, he was the babyface, because at Rumble he just got the biggest pop.
J. Ron Kramer from Pro Wrestling Owning says, easily the stuff with Mean Gene visiting Ric Flair's home and riding in his car, etc., in the run-up to Starrcade 93 with Vader. That match really packs an emotional punch for me, and I don't think it would have gotten there without that build. One of the few truly great things WCW pulled off from start to finish.
Yeah, it's funny, this one didn't occur to me, actually, at all when I was thinking about this for build-ups. But, and again, they had that retirement angle played in, didn't they? And that always... You know, this is at a time when we're not jaded that much, or certainly I'm not. at the time, Kieran, at the time, it's one of those matches where there is a genuine sense of emotion. You see it from the audience on the night at Starrcade. You see it from, Flair's fantastic at that sort of thing. And the way you've got Mean Gene at the house and Mean Gene riding in the limo with him. And it's all done in a very sort of underplayed manner. It's not bombastic. It's not over the top. It's sort of Mean Gene. It's all very, very sober, I think, is the best way I can describe it. And that gives it that gravitas that it needs, but that is an... I'm disappointed it's one that didn't occur to me. I think it's an excellent choice.
Yeah, it is. Even in the run-up to the show itself, and obviously what he mentions there is stuff that actually happened on Starrcade, where the riding in the limousine, a lot of a last-match talk. Even in the run-up, they had a lot of sports guys like Charles Barkley on television hyping the match up and putting Flair over. Obviously, it helps. It built to was fantastic in the match and in the post match too.
I believe Charles Barkley's linked to Ric Flair finance as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Is he really?
What really kind of helps is just kind of how over and badass Vader was at that point as well. I mean, the guy was being fed everybody, even Sting, and he was just like chowing through everybody. And it's just this point where like Ric Flair's taking a stand, and it's like he's the shining beacon of WCW. He's returned, and he's gonna be the one that does it, but he has to put it on the line. And it's like Ric Flair's a great wrestler, but Vader's a fucking beast. It was just believable. And you mentioned about like all the stuff in the limousine with Mean Gene. Actually, to his credit, came across very realistic. It comes across as like someone's just happened to turn on a camera as Mean Gene's talking to Rick, and Rick seems very somber. There's not the ranting and ravings of Crazy Rick or the swagger of 80s champion Rick. He's just there, and he's just very kind of humble. He's just like, yeah, this could be my last match. It just comes across as like, you know, they're not acting, they're not on, they're not switched on. They're just them. And it went all the way through the show, even if we go past the build up to the match and after the match, like little kind of things where they're celebrating afterwards, and like Sting is in the locker room with him, and Sting's, you know, congratulates him, goes, well done, Rick, you know, and so on. It just all came across as very genuine.
Big Boss 1979 from F4W says, not really a build-up in the traditional sense, but Survivor Series 97 had Shawn and Brett shooting on each other since Brett's 96 return. They would be feuding with other people, but still talking shit about each other on interviews. Crowbro from F4W also agrees on this, and says, pretty much ever since HBK came back that spring, you could tell it was all building to those two eventually. I hated the Heart so much, I never accepted that Shawn actually turned heel. Just figured that Taker took the accidental chair shot at SummerSlam too far. This is a funny one here.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Shawn was never a heel.
Yeah, in terms of a great build, I mean, it's great in the sense that you can tell they really don't like each other, I don't know if I'd call it classic wrestling build, in the sense that they did put the match off like three or four times. If you're not looking at it from the perspective of knowing what's going on in the real world, yeah. I can see as a fan just watching it, just thinking, God, I want this match to happen, because they're teasing it and they say it's going to happen at Mania, and then it doesn't. It's going to happen at King of the Ring, then it doesn't. Finally, it happens at Survivor Series. You get Bret Hart calling Shawn Michaels and Triple H a homo and stuff like that. Mm.
Racist attack on the Nation. Don't forget that.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to put that in the section of best build for anything. But
It's a great build. If you watch Wrestling with Shadows, that's a great build for the match.
Yeah,
just watch that documentary. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I don't know if it really comes into the category for this show, because it was real, really. So
yeah, it was an angle.
There was no art involved. It was all reality.
Exactly,
so in one respect, I'll agree. But then, for the purposes of this show, I can't really. So.
Jake Roberts, parole officer from the UK fan forum, says Steiner versus Triple H had an awesome build-up.
Oh no!
It got the proper big star treatment. Shame the match shit all over it.
No!
That is the very definition of a troll. Yes. I think there.
Yeah. You know what though?
And I'm not, no! No!
Don't you fucking dare!
Not the pose down. Not the arm wrestling.
or Triple H getting stripped of his clothes so he can be Ric Flair. On Raw. There's no defense for this. I'm gonna try. This was shocking.
I'd rather see the pose down of the Warrior and Rick Rude again before I sit through that.
Oh yeah, well that was a good pose down.
Gorgeous Dale Newstead from TPWW forum says Brett versus Owen was tremendous. A nice slow build even before Survivor Series 93, culminating with Owen's turn at the Rumble in 94. That match was emotional because the Heart Boy seemed desperate to win the tag belts together, and Owen even more desperate to get out of Brett's shadow. There was a feeling of urgency in the match versus the Quebecers, and Brett, being the master of psychology he was able to make himself the ultimate sympathetic babyface with a knee injury, which would come back to haunt him in their match at Mania. And yet in all of this, in the heat of the emotion, one had to sympathise with Owen's frustration. It was heartbreaking when the brothers split, because their connection seemed so genuine. The emotions were real from the point of Owen's turn, regardless of whether the WWF machine was behind them. Each match had a sense of urgency. Without spilling an ounce of blood, they partook in a blood feud and were at one another's throats on and off for 3 years. And from the inception of the storyline, it took about 5 or 6 months for them to tangle, and only wrestled at SummerSlam after Mania, while they kept building Owen as a thorn in Brett's side. So I guess two separate sets of build here, one for Mania, one for SummerSlam, but the one for Mania is the one that obviously sticks in my mind as the propelling of Owen from a jobber to the stars to someone who can actually go with Brett.
Yeah, the steps they took was great, and when he kicked his leg out of his leg, it was great. So, fantastic story told, all being said, yeah.
Yeah, I just love that promo that Brett does. After the Survivor Series shoving contest, and before they become a team again, they make up over the holidays and all that stuff. And Brett did that really great low-key promo where he just says, in no circumstances will I ever, ever fight my own brother.
Yeah.
Never. That's, not ever.
No, that's it. And you... Again, to stress that word, that authenticity to something. And Brett is fantastic the way he comes across as very sympathetic. They reference the knee injury there. The sort of undertones of the promos before the match with the Quebecers, that sense that, you know, I don't want to say charitable, but that's sort of partly the way it comes across, or at least the way Owen plays it up, of Brett putting his singles career on hold because he wants to do this with his brother. He wants to win the tag belts with his brother for the family.
Yeah.
You have the match at WrestleMania, you have that great bit at the end of Mania where Owen finally gets that, you know, he gets that win over his big brother, he's on cloud nine, but then Brett wins the belt. So, you know, Owen can't have this one night to gloat over his brother. From the heel perspective, you can see it all, can't you?
Yeah, it's great.
It all plays up. And then you get to SummerSlam, you get to the cage match. Jim Neidhart's brought in as a blast from the past. You have the Hart family on the front row and a suspiciously juiced up looking Davey Boy Smith. Natural.
Let's not make any allegations.
Okay. But
he's not going to fucking sue us.
But no, it's an entertaining feud for us. It's relatable. It's great matches from an in-ring perspective, and it at least helps elevate Owen from where he was previously, even if he doesn't go on to sort of the higher peaks that you'd hope for.
Even if you just said the build up to WrestleMania and you stopped right there, the build was very nice, but it actually continues on as well. And it, you know, little things like you know Brett does the promo about the, you know, when Owen was a kid and he's looking over the crib and so on, like looking down at him as a baby and so on. It's like, that's going to be the same when I'm beating you and I'm looking over the cage, like, you know, you losing.
That's
and
great.
So on. Loads of little great stuff. And also if you read Bret Hart's book, you know, to their credit, they both kayfabed it as well, you know, and they actually chose not to travel together as well to try and, you know, put it across to all the fans as well that this was like a serious a blood feud. And I really like the inclusion of the family and possibly juiced up Davey Boy and Jim the Anvil Neidhart, because I always laugh at Jim anyway, but it's just like Jim just looks like such a prick at ringside. He's wearing like
SummerSlam.
Is he wearing a fanny pack, or is it British Bulldog? Someone's wearing a fanny
pack. They're both totem, surely.
It's Bulldog, so I can clearly see it when he gets knocked over the guardrail and drags Hannah over with him.
How about Davey's look at SummerSlam with the fucking long hair and the
glasses.
The glasses, but the sleeveless shirt. He looks he's got lesbian.
He's got like Harry Potter glasses on and everything.
China.
Well, he is bizarre.
But then Anvil's wearing like blue and black striped leggings with tennis shoes, and he's just sitting there with his arms crossed. It's like Bruce is just barraging with shit because Bruce wants to be involved in everything. And just as I think it was like Todd Pengel, whoever it was that was interviewing him, just kind of moves away from it, you can just see just Jim Neidhart looking at Bruce going, "Don't you point your finger at me!" You know, it's just like this ridiculous stuff of Jim Neidhart, you know, leaping over the barrier as soon as the win happens.
And I think we should mention Lawler as well, like backing up Owen.
Lawler
when he was worthwhile.
Moving on here to a different one. Nobody actually made a lot of people did vote for this, but no one made a big argument. But since we're on the topic of brother feuds, the other one of note that had great build was the Undertaker Kane first 6 months of build for WrestleMania 14. There are many times on this podcast, and we've dragged poor old Glenn Jacobs through the ringer, but this is one we're going to mention him positively, because I think the build to the first match was really, really damn good, considering the fact that it started out like an angle that sounded like it was going to be utter dog shit. From Kane's debut and just destroying everybody, and you know, again the similar thing to Brett, where Taker's again, I'm not gonna fight him, to Kane, you know, okay, well, if you're not gonna fight me, I guess I'll back you up. And then double crossed him at the Rumble, setting his casket on fire. As much as that kind of supernatural element came in, and I wasn't a big fan of Kane setting the crew on fire, I thought the build for that first match, I thought the build was really good for Kane and Taker.
Yeah, when you have the initial sort of Paul Bearer promos about the fire and Kane is alive, you do fear the worst initially, don't you? You think, oh God, where the hell's this going to go? Thankfully, it surpassed all my expectations in that first 6 months. You know, you have the debut at Hell in a Cell, the spectacle of him ripping the door off, and the fact that it's, you know, 6'10" Undertaker, who larger guys on the roster, this giant of a man, mythical sort of being, if you like. The notion of him refusing to fight back against anyone is quite a contrast to what you would associate with the Undertaker up to that point. So when you tie the sort of the family element into it, the fact that you have a couple of instances on Raw where Kane just beats him down and he won't fight back. You have a tease where you think he might finally fight back, where he grabs him by the throat, but then relents and gets beaten down. So you have that sympathy playing for a character in The Undertaker that you don't necessarily associate sympathy with. You know, it's a real contrasting element to what you would normally associate with the character. And you don't have that much Undertaker on TV during this period. You know, he's not on TV for a few weeks in the sort of the build up to Survivor Series. Obviously, he's not on Survivor Series at all. The fleeting appearances of Undertaker at least helps keep that sort of that suspense there, and the notion that you're not giving everything away straight away, no matter how much Vince Russo may have wanted to.
Yeah.
It was the first real step towards humanizing the Undertaker as a character by presenting Kane as something that was so inhuman. This monolithic entity. As a kid, I mean, I was a big mark for the angle, just for the whole crazy wackiness of it, but I did even then worry that The Undertaker might lose some mystique coming out of it, and I think that we're fortunate in many ways that he didn't, really. But yeah, it's the ability to humanise a character, which we've seen since with The Undertaker. Nowadays, his current annual run, he's still the Phenom and all that, but he's got that humanized character now. He's got this, he's the old guy, and he's a fighter, and he won't give up. Oh my God, he's become Cena. Never mind.
in concept, it was, oh, this is going to be fucking atrocious. This is going to be something to turn the volume down when friends are in the room or whatever, but it was up until that first match, it was really good.
Moving on here to TAF KAC from UK Fan Forum. That rolls off the tongue. Brett asked him for Survivor Series 96. Simple but effective. From what I recall, Brett wanted to come back to face the man he thought was the best, Austin. Meanwhile, Austin was really starting to find his way, and there was a really good black and white video package hyping it. That is great, actually. That's the one where he's you're completely pathetic. You got you ran to Canada to tell people because you got beat by Sean, the sexy boy. After I'm finished, you can go back to Canada knowing you got beat by a real man. You know, that's great stuff. It also has some decent lines from both, which really outline the characters. Austin simply says something on the lines of "put a letter S in front of Hitman." You know exactly what I think of Brett. Well, Brett has the more old school vibe and talks about MSG. It's not a church, but it is holy ground. I can't remember who it is that says it, but there was something about they say people dream in black and white, but tonight you're going to be dreaming in red, which I believe is Austin. We actually talked about this not too long ago, but Austin's coming of age in the couple of months before this match, when they announced it was going to be Brett Austin at Survivor Series in the comeback match. Really fun. Just to watch the evolution of Austin is great.
Yeah, it was when he was given the focus of the feud with Brett, and he just completely rammed the ball, and it was the birth of Steve Austin as we know it, and for that on its own, you give anything but two thumbs up for this.
Yeah, I don't want to make a comparison to Conor McGregor because it seems quite ridiculous, but in terms of like one man doing so, it seemed like he was everywhere doing the promos. Yeah, he's on LiveWire, they're doing the video packages, he's doing it on Raw, he's constantly...
Yeah, you're looking out for what he's doing this week, what's doing next.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Because, and just, he's given time, he's given a bit, he's given the camera, and he's just going to town with it, and this was his chance, and it was grabbing the ball and running with it.
That's why I made the Conor comparison. The idea of, okay, here's a guy who's actually got something, and they're running with it because they're building it for Brett, but obviously by actually getting behind a new guy who's got something, it's like this, like I said, coming of age for Austin.
Yeah, as much as we probably all feel sick when we hear the McMahon line about, you know, guys better take their opportunity, when you look at it in that context, you can kind of say, I mean, now we can be, there's the debate about overly scripting and stuff, and guys aren't given the opportunity for free reign and be pretty creative, but at the same time, if Austin was given material and had an input into the material that was, you know, a bit back and forth, I still think it'd been better than anything else on today's roster. So
yeah, absolutely. Moving on to one here, I want to get everybody's thoughts on. King Pitcos from the UK Fan Forum says, Shawn Michaels and Undertaker for WrestleMania 26. Michaels' performances from the moment he started demanding the rematch when picking up the Slammy was marvellous. His utter desperation to right the wrong of the previous year to the point of the ultimate sacrifice and fuck, is Shawn actually going to retire, made it as gripping as any build I can think of. And Damnator from TPWW Forums agrees and says, Shawn Taker 2 has to be one of, if not the most epic WrestleMania match promo videos of the past 5 years, especially when you see Shawn reply to Undertaker, "If I can't beat you at Mania, I have no career."
That's another one where the video really trims it down to its core elements. And there's a few of those lines, like I know that everyone loves the "I have no career" line, but it is so fucking corny. I mean, that is such, and it's not even really delivered very well. It's the exact thing you had to say in that moment. It was the exact right line for the moment, but fuck me, was it corny. As, "No, you don't understand, I have no career." And you expect, and everyone in the audience goes, "Ooh." That's not a reaction you can really get from the crowd. It's not a pop line. But that video, yeah, trims it down. The music choice was fantastic.
Running up that hill by Placebo.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I like that makes them stand out, particularly with the music videos, is their choice of music, because there was that era where it was fucking Creed over and over. And, you know, that we all loved it then. The ending of this episode will be us all singing "My Sacrifice" in unison, ladies and gentlemen.
My arms are not wide open for a Creed music video.
Oh, I see what you did there. But no, they're moving on from there, and then, you know, And you had ones like the Limp Bizkit one, which was of its time. But each, you get a feel for the era from the music they use. The Daniel Bryan one, from fairly recently, was another one which wasn't a music choice I was expecting, but perfectly worked for it.
The Monster music.
That's
video,
the one. Yeah. So
the whole thing becomes Shawn's quest to get the match, which I really love, because the whole, "I'm going to enter the Rumble to try and win because Taker's got the belt," and then he slips off the rope and he's just crestfallen because his whole point... Yeah, exactly. Luke's doing a miming impression.
This is great radio. I'm doing a mime, folks.
Yeah, and just that, the look on his face and the dejected thing of walking to the back, and he's got to come up with another plan, so he costs Taker the belt at the chamber.
The way Shawn plays it with desperation, you know, real credit to Shawn throughout the feud. You mentioned there about some sort of uneasy moments in the feud, if you like. There aren't too many I relate to this one in particular, because I think it is more about Sean's quest and the desperation and the fact that he's willing to put his career on the line.
Old man, I think, Michaels.
I associate the hokiness, if you like, more with their match the year before.
Is it because he comes down from heaven?
No, because they play.
Does the music play?
Yeah. Actually, in terms of hokey lines.
No. I don't mean specifically lines, but events like the hiding under the casket and that sort of thing.
That's great.
But in terms of that, it's all done very well, but in terms of that hokey nature that Luke was alluding to, I associate it more with that first match than I do this second one. I think this second one is much more serious in tone. Sean plays it brilliantly throughout, and of course, like I say, culminates in that moment where he's willing to rob Taker of the belt, to piss Taker off, to the point where he feels he has to accept. I think it is a really good build. And again, as you said before, Luke, to agree with you, the music video just helps really play into that.
And not to forget, there's actually a good one the following week for Taker 2 with Johnny Cash's Ain't No Grave,
oh, God, yeah,
which is a really good follow-up video.
Yeah. Shawn Michaels, the greatest mannerisms in the history of pro wrestling. Yeah. I'm going to play Placebo on the way home and have myself a cry.
Yeah, I will say that on the subject of hokey lines for 25, that was the one where, and you can tell when they've written a line they think so fucking great, because Michael Cole repeats about 15 times afterwards, the whole it can be hell trying to get to heaven.
Fucking shite.
Moving on to a couple here from the early 90s. Arrogantly Grateful from WrestlingForum.com says, the first that comes to mind for me is the whole Jake Roberts-Rick Martel feud they had building up to WrestleMania 7. The feud started at the back end of 1990 where Rick blinded Jake on the Brother Love Show. The reason why I felt this was good is because they built it up over a few pay-per-views where they didn't exactly clash, but they were close, and there were plenty of opportunities. Survivor Series, for example, and the best one was the Rumble, where the crowd got really excited when Jake came in, and Martel had been in for a while because he had the Longevity Award that year, and the crowd went nuts when Jake came out. The best thing was Martel mocking Jake after he was eliminated in the Rumble, which just added more and more to the feud, and the crowd just wanted him to get his hands on Martel, which he eventually did, but that build-up was spot-on because it built up the frustrations of the crowd, so that when that moment finally happened, they loved it. It was great. The Martel team, the visionaries at the Survivor Series, which is a nice little play on the fact that he blinded Jake.
Just Martel as a douchey heel is fantastic. Yeah, and he puts the contact lens in, so he has like a completely white eye, which I don't think is medically accurate. But obviously it's for wrestling, it's all fake. Hey, whilst I don't think it goes down as one of the greatest builds ever, I think it certainly had certain points of merit.
Yeah, very good mid-card feud.
I just want to say quickly, I know you've been sprayed in the face of quite a few things in your time, Chase, but if you haven't been sprayed in the face with arrogance, then how do you know that doesn't happen to your eyes?
Perhaps so, as a matter of fact.
I almost feel like I'm being baited with this one. As soon as Liam started reading it, G did what can only be described as a D'Lo Brown impression with his head with a shit-eating grin on his face. expecting me to sort of launch into a tirade, I think, and...
Are you not right now?
No, I'm not about to at all, because as dog shit as the match itself is, and people can try and defend it almost to the point where I wonder if they are blind,
the build
itself is pretty good, in truth. You know, it's played out over a number of months. You do have that tease at Survivor Series. You have that element of the Rumble where Jake doesn't get his hands on him, and it does build into that
desperation.
Martel eliminates him. Where, you know, Jake just can't get one over on Martel, can't get his revenge. Almost to the point where you think, just imagine how much better it would have been if they'd had an actual normal match, not a comedy blindfold match.
From a similar time frame, Arrogantly Grateful also says, another good build was DiBiase and Virgil. Virgil was time and time again humiliated by DiBiase, and there were so many times the crowd wanted Virgil to snap and turn, and it was pushed to the max. When Virgil finally did snap and he hit Ted with a $1 million belt, the crowd went mental. I hope Virgil gets his $1 million he's been wanting lately, as DiBiase clearly didn't feel he was worth any of his retirement fund. Have you heard about this Virgil?
Yeah.
The Virgil GoFundMe where he says he wants to be a millionaire, so please give him $1 million. Fucking Virgil.
This, at least a dynamic and a step-by-step guide of how to do this. This is wrestling booking 101, I think, for getting a subordinate over poor guy, the schlub, who's been made to do the most ridiculous things.
I believe schlub is Patterson's pet name for it.
Yeah. You know, it's just that's astounding. He's just doing all sorts of shit. You know, he's been demeaned and so on.
I gotta mention, while you're on the kick of demeaning,
yeah,
the video you've seen where DiBiase makes Virgil massage his feet.
Yeah.
And he's just like, Virgil, the toes.
Yeah. Yeah. Get the bunions. Yeah. Work the bunions, Virgil. It's just all very, and I don't know whether this is intentional or not, whether this is just, I don't know, Vince's twisted humour, but like the fact that Virgil's black as well, I don't know. It's, I don't know whether that's like a key thing into it, just the whole repression, just embarrassing this guy. And just Ted DiBiase just plays it off so beautifully. I mean, he's played off the whole character beautifully before, you know, knocking. And I think one of the most key individuals in this turn was Roddy Piper on commentary, where he's willing him on. He's just there going, come on, Virgil, just stand up against him and so on. He's just willing him on. and just when it does actually explode and just all happens and so on, and it just turns, it's just great. I mean, when the booking's right, when you're doing proper wrestling 101, you can get any piece of shit over. Because quite frankly, after this, Virgil was nothing. So this is just more thing of, that's why I consider this booking 101, because if you can get someone like Virgil over, then this is something that you do over and over and over again.
That Yokozuna's for real, man.
I've never seen you take such a shellacking, Virgil.
This crowd at the Rumble goes absolutely, you know, bonkers for Virgil. Just shows you how successful a build it is. I always love the point of it. You've got Piper on commentary sort of urging Virgil on after the match. He drops the $1 million title and demands Virgil pick it up, and then throws in the line, remember your sick mother. You know, really tugging on it there at that point. And the way that Virgil just blasts him with the belt, the crowd goes completely off their rock, and you just have that look,
yeah,
on Virgil's face just encapsulates it all. It's a fantastic build and another fantastic suggestion.
I think Virgil was a bit of an ingrate, to be perfectly honest.
He deserved the poor treatment.
Well, you know, some people aren't happy to have a job, you know what I mean?
how many times did he miss the bunions?
We've got to work the bunions. And I will say, just to chase, yeah, it absolutely was racial. Of course it was.
Yeah, because that's the thing, whether it was intentional or not, when you've got a white oppressor, like, kind of bullying, like, his black manservant, it's just like, whether it's intentional or not, that's how it's being portrayed, isn't it? Maybe that part's a little bit cheap, I don't know, for 91 standards, but the rest of it's just too perfect to let that overshadow it.
It's an interesting example to me of a build-up to a moment, yeah, rather than the build-up to a match, rather than the build-up for a character. It's a build-up to a singular moment that the crowd wanted to see. Much as we spoke about Sting earlier, which was the combination of building up to the moment of his return, building up to the match. This only had one thing. This just had one aspect, but that aspect was right up to 11. This is something that everybody watching this show wants to see. There is nobody out there except old man Jones over here who was on the side of DiBiase. But you know, there's nobody.
Literally, you know, 30 seconds ago, Kieran said he was on DiBiase's side.
I know, I thought about it.
This is not a generational issue.
It's not about the money, it's not about the match, it's not about the feud, it's certainly not about fucking Virgil. It's about this moment that everybody wants to see, and everyone in the building every time wanted to be a part of. And they were being constantly, the word isn't let down, but they're slightly disappointed in every building they went through. It's, oh, we thought we were going to be there to see it. And that was the time, of course, the final time when those people in that building were the ones to be there to see it, to experience it, and of course the pop was completely fucking off the charts. And it should be considered that, you know, they've done this kind of shit again in many kind of smaller contexts, never given it the same amount of time, never given it the same amount of
Sandow,
absolutely. They've done it with Cena probably twice at this point,
yeah,
in various
Nexus
bits.
Steel.
Nexus Steel, that kind of shit. They've done it. Who was bankrupt? Was it Big Show or some shit where he had no money or some fucking thing? I don't know.
Shawn and JBL.
There you go. But they've done it again and again and again. It's never worked. Not even remotely close to the same area.
Del Rio and Ricardo was the pile of shit.
That's it. And it's an example of well, really, the big differential. You're using more charismatic, more interesting wrestlers in the same role. But the reason it's never worked really, as I think G said, is the time frame. Because they usually try nowadays to condense this into a 2-month period, yeah. or condense it even smaller than that. And that's never going to pay off.
What you get nowadays, guys get brought together for the purposes of spin them up.
Yes.
And it's over before it's even had time to warm up. Whereas this was, as you say, it was real. He'd been with him forever, so it was a proper split. And now we're going to see this guy on his own.
Cobra 1000 from the UK Fan Forum says, one of my favourite build-ups was Cody Rhodes and Goldust versus The Shield for their jobs at Battleground 2013. It was the shining light of the year where Vince tried to tell us Daniel Bryan was shit and there were no new stars. We were given Cody Rhodes and Goldust. The reason why I liked it is because it was vaguely rooted in real life, recessions, personal issues, and family costing people jobs. It was a great storyline for pro wrestling. It was also the right amount of honesty and kayfabe. It had emotion. It felt real, and that is when wrestling's at its best. I loved the authority throwing their weight around and acting like dicks. Cody and Goldust had both lost to Orton, and it seemed like they were gone. Then Steph made it even more personal by having the hired goon Big Show knock out Dusty. And that's when Cody and Goldust got mad. They showed up on Raw the week after and attacked The Shield, and the place went nuts. The week after that, Triple H invited the Rhodes boys to Raw and offered the ultimatum: beat The Shield at Battleground and get your jobs back. Then just to add up to the build, the three of them deliver a stunning promo, and the match more than delivers for a contender for match of the year. The dysfunctional family came together in the end, and did it hurt The Shield? Not a bit. But Steph buying Cody Rhodes the gift card to Bed Bath & Beyond after she fired him was pretty good stuff. But I didn't mind this one at all. The promo before the match itself, it's quite good because Cody gets the last word and he kind of is the star of the segment, but it's really good stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like one of those things lost in time because of obviously the fact that it eventually went nowhere, and also the fact that pretty much everything over the last 10 years has gone nowhere. But this is an isolated incident. If you just watch it, it was well done. There was nice stuff, and it really actually came from nothing. If you watch it, it was just like a random throwaway thing where it's like Cody Rhodes made some sort of smart ass comment, and they just decided, right, well, your job's on the line, so wrestle, bitch, any freaking losers. And so they bring back Goldust, who's like freaking like he's on. Got, you know, Dustin switched on.
He was going for a job. He wanted the job.
Yeah, he was going for a job. He was in great shape, and he works at like a fantastic match with Orton. So it's like two great matches in a row, and just kind of fails. And even at a very short time period, it felt kind of quite heartbreaking that Goldust couldn't do it. The running attacks and so on. The crowd did buy it. Cody Rhodes and Goldust as a team was over, and it worked for like about 2 months. And then they got bored.
And they jobbed him to the Outlaws, which was the end of it.
Jobbed him to the Outlaws in January, if I remember right. Yeah. And then that was it. And they've done nothing since.
Moving on, though, to a very strong candidate here. Heyman from TPWW Forum says, with Austin and Shawn Michaels before WrestleMania 14, you just knew that a change in the guard was about to take place, and that the freight train known as the Austin Machine was about to take this company to an entirely different level. With Tyson added into the mix, you simply couldn't ignore this pay-per-view. I thought the week-to-week stuff with Shawn constantly super kicking Austin trying to get to him, but he can't. There's always some reason he doesn't get to him. I thought it was really good stuff.
Does anyone remember that?
I do.
No one else does. All that matters is Tyson and Austin. At the time, he was even as like the biggest Shawn fan, maybe the second joint first in the room. It was all about Austin. We knew Shawn was going, so Austin's getting the title. It's his time, and it was just about that ascension. And the Tyson tie-in, it was just perfect.
Yeah, Tyson joined DX. I thought was really good there. I thought it was a really clever touch. Mm.
Austin's time on the condition that The Undertaker bullies Shawn Michaels into it. Let's not forget that, you Shawn Marks in the room.
Was you there, old one, Jones? Did you see it with your cataract's eyes? No, you didn't. So propagate a myth.
I've seen some things in my time.
The war for one.
No, much to Kieran's point, I must admit, whilst you mentioning about the super kicking and Austin being so close but so far in terms of that build, since you've mentioned it, I do recall it, but just the mere mention of the storyline as a general rule, the first thing that pops into my mind is Tyson. But it was done really well. The fact that they had Tyson join DX, which maybe it's just me being a bit naive and young at the time, I never saw coming at the time. A real shock value to it. And so that was fantastic. The Austin-Tyson standoff in the ring which was played up very much like you would get at weigh-ins, at the boxing and that sort of thing.
You can't completely discount Shawn Michaels from this build-up due to the fact that he was at the top of his kind of his heelish act, so to say, and outside the ring as well, I'm guessing. But we saw the babyface turn in 97, and they built it and built it and built it, and he executed it at the exact right time on the right show. It is unfortunate Shawn Michaels wasn't in full capabilities to put Austin over in a classic match, but the match was decent enough to get obviously Austin over and to start this all off.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna drop another Kieran conspiracy call. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Yeah, Shawn was trying to fuck him over in this match. I have no doubt. Shawn was trying to babyface himself with the sympathy for the back. The speed he's going out to start with, and all of a sudden, it's actually when he's getting heat, he slows down, he makes it awkward, it's clunky. It makes Austin look shit because he can't even go himself when he's getting the heat on Austin. He was trying to fuck Steve over, I have no doubt. But saying that, when he comes out and he's all pilled up and he shakes the camera, I'm the fucking man, he looked cool as fuck.
Bringing celebrities, obviously, it has the risk of taking away the spotlight from the performers. At the end of the day, you're building towards a match. And of course, with this one as well, Tyson was topical. And if there is anything that Vince McMahon is not, it is topical. And there's only been, you know, one or two other uses of celebrities that were really of the moment and used well. Certainly... You know, Kieran had mentioned to me off air one of them, which hopefully we'll get to talk about, and that's another great use of a celebrity to push something bigger than themselves.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Obviously, Mr. T at WrestleMania 1 stands out as an obvious candidate. Another one, obviously, WrestleMania 23, the use of Donald Trump and the build up there. Kieran, I know you want to sound off on this one a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, look, when we're looking at these, all the different suggestions, I think the one thing that stands out to me is, no matter how long the build has been, whether it's over a year or whether it's a quick turnaround of 2 weeks in some instances, it's what really matters is the concept of the match really transcending and grabbing the attention. And for me, the Trump McMahon hair match, although we talked about Umaga and the Blaster, weren't particularly great in the build-up for me. Just the concept of having a hair match with Donald Trump, I mean, it's genius, really. And you look, it really came home to me looking at the stuff about Trump running for the Republican seat this week. And I think it was when he was burying McCain about his war record, and he said, "Oh yeah, look, you talk about personal insults. I've insulted me about my hair my whole life." And it just really struck me. It's like, yeah, that Vince took this common theme that's in the American's conscience.
His gimmick.
Yeah, he took Trump's gimmick and he made money out of it, and it was absolutely, to put that on into a match, even if the week by week wasn't particularly memorable compared to some of the other things, just that concept is something that really transcends into the common psyche, and it bore fruit by the buy rate it did. So in terms of that aspect, in terms of taking a fundamental element to a feud and transcending, I think that was really good. I think it just deserved mention, really.
Yeah, I will say, from a build-up perspective, I love the contract signing scene where Steve Austin goes up to Vince and says he's got a problem with bald-headed people. Yeah. And then Vince, he looks horrified, and then Lashley catches his eye in the corner, and Lashley's just staring in the hole. Like, if you say anything, I'll fucking kill you. It's getting to one here that has to be mentioned. Ask C from the UK fan forum. Hogan versus Savage was the WWF at their long-term booking best. A slow burn that ignited that terrific Saturday night's main event angle. In a cartoon world, this was a story built on universally human issues. Maluko from TPWW says, "From a story point of view, I would go with the Mega Powers implosion. It was a roller coaster of a build, and both guys played the role brilliantly. Perfect for remembering how good an all-around performer Savage was too. Hearing Hulk talk about how he drove him to another level by slapping him in that famous training room segment explained why it all felt so real." Fruit of the Loins from the F4W message board says, "Mega Powers exploding was the best build in the history of the business." And Haphazard, also from F4W, says, "That is correct. The best thing the WWF ever did by a considerable margin. It's been downhill since."
We might as well go home, folks.
So yeah, Hogan Savage. Carl, I know you want to talk about this one.
When you proposed this as a podcast, Liam, I must admit this is one of the first ones that sprung to mind. It plays a bit into the notion of what we were talking about earlier, how you've got that year-long build but without the arbitrary date to factor in terms of the fans' mind, so you have that anticipation to it. You know, it's a very natural story in the sense of, if you strip away the title belt, it almost boils down to the paranoid, overbearing boyfriend and old Thunderlips himself, Lust Hogan.
Lust Hogan.
But there's that sort of natural tie-in there. But it is the subtlety to it that I really liked. The fact that you have them as the tag team, and the initial stages of it aren't so overt. It's the odd glance from Savage. It's the fact that he hugs Liz, and you get it a little bit first at SummerSlam after they've beat DiBiase and Andre. Then you get it again at Survivor Series when they're the last two survivors. You get that glance over the promo with Jesse in the back after the match, where Savage doesn't really want to reference Hogan too much, just talks about himself being the survivor, and Ventura's a little bit afterwards, just sort of sowing the seeds. And then obviously it escalates a bit. You get to the Rumble, you get Savage being eliminated, you know, in his paranoia thinking Hogan's done it on purpose, Liz playing the peacemaker, this sort of, you know, the dainty figure in between the two hulking blokes trying to calm everything down. You get to Saturday night's main event, and timing cues aside from when we're coming back from ad breaks and what's live and what isn't,
design.
You get that great bit in the back where Savage attacks and you just got Hogan on the floor talking about my eye and all that sort of thing, and it all builds up, and it's just a really well paced out feud over the course of a year, which I just think is done brilliantly.
Going to one that had a little bit of a shorter build than that, LCC from UK Fan Forum says, the one I loved at the time was Angle versus Michaels built to WrestleMania. I love them starting at the Rumble with Angle getting eliminated by Michaels and then fucking wrecking him. It seemed like quite the natural feud starter. The outperforming Michaels with his ladder match and defeating of Jannetty. Angle just mind fucking Michaels by bringing out Sherry with him and slapping on the ankle lock. Michaels dressed as the cameraman and sneak attacking Kurt. It was great. This was a proper dream match at the time. They successfully built Angle as a sadistic manic heel with Michaels as a babyface you could actually get behind. This was at a time when a SmackDown guy and a Raw guy feuding was a big deal. To top it all off, hearing Kurt sing "I'm such a sexy Kurt, I'll make your ankle hurt" is hilarious and was my ringtone for about 3 years.
I absolutely love it. I don't always think about this immediately in terms of build, but it was the sexy Kurt which just got me, where he comes out in like the leather trousers and so on, and he's just really giving it his all but looking like a complete douche. I was begging for him to come out as sexy Kurt at WrestleMania, just with the whole gear on, just sexy Kurt make your ankle hurt, you know. It's just like,
woo, hands off the merchandise. Yeah,
it's just a great thing of just like the most kind of like nerdy kind of guy trying to be the boy toy. It's just hilarious.
Yeah. Well, on a build we won't get to, as fun as this was, and as much as he, you know, winning the WrestleMania match against Shawn Michaels clean, the feud afterwards, the build up with him and Booker T, I want to have sex with your wife angle.
I believe the term gutter slut was used at one point.
Gutter slut. Yeah. Well, not just any kind of sex, but bestiality sex. Yeah.
This sounds great.
Honestly, that promo is just...
Yeah, putting that to one side, please.
But segueing nicely to another WrestleMania 21 feud here. Tony Soprano from WrestlingForum.com. Triple H versus Batista. A perfect storyline that took a mid-card wrestler with no mic or wrestling skills and turned him into the biggest star in the WWE. The only time I ever cheered for Batista as a babyface. And Slasher from Pro Wrestling Only also says, the WWE screwed up Randy Orton's ascension to main eventer, but I really dug how they made up for it with the rise of the smarter-than-you-think pimp suit wearing animal that is Batista. There is a reason why Batista is a bigger star than Orton ever could be. Actually, I thought this was like, considering how poorly they did the Orton one, this is like a minor miracle that they did this so well with the subtle teases over the course of like 2-3 months before they did the eventual turn with Batista on Raw. But I thought this is like unbelievable that they did this during a period of time when, again, they were very panicky.
Yeah, it's kind of got the subtleties of almost like the Hogan Savage feud, and it's kind of got that organic nature where the crowd actually wanted it as well, and they went with it. So it was completely in keeping with most of the bills and turns they've done recently. Absolutely made Batista into a star, which, I mean, given what happened to Orton, which was a crying shame, I could never have seen it coming at that point with this jacked up bodybuilder. Not much more to him, but he was Deacon Batista, whatever
Deacon
he was.
Batista.
So yeah, I mean, absolutely made him a star. Patience, and then eventually they pulled the trigger when he
it was on the contract signing where like he was going to have to
pick
which belt
to go
to
get him
for.
To, yeah, they were trying to encourage him to go for the SmackDown belt. Was it? Yeah, just really good stuff.
Fake the JBL limo to try and Monroe to try and get him to fight JBL. Yeah. Little stuff like that. Even like the things where you have like. Just the coincidence, like, he knew it was going to happen. Batista was always the smarter guy, which I loved about the view. It was never he's a moron, he's being played here. It was, he knows deep down. Like, he was actually, the way they played out in Stone, after he won the Rumble, they were playing up that he was going to announce that he was going to fight Triple H the day after, and that's when JBL appears on the screen to, don't you dare fucking challenge me for the belt. It's that nice thing of they're teasing it, they're going to do it, but we never actually get to see it. Very much like Virgil, we're never going to get to see that moment. And then we did get the moment, and he powerbombs to the table, and this is fucking great.
The key component to it all is what you two have said, that the fact that he's in many respects, he's one step ahead of Triple H throughout the feud. He knows, deep down, he knows what the score is. He knows what's going on here. He's just sort of almost biding his time. I think there's even a little skit where Flair and Triple H are talking in the locker room, and you just see Batista out of view of them, just by the side of the door, hearing everything.
Yeah, this is right before the turn.
Yeah, it's the antithesis, if you like, of the Sting run in WCW, where it's, you know, Sting is booked as the world's dumbest babyface, where partner after partner turns on him. You know, Ric Flair's attacked him several times. He believes in Ric Flair for some ungodly reason, and Ric Flair turns on him again. it's the antithesis of that, and it just, you know, it's not. It's the way in which, to me anyway, it's the way in which the feud doesn't insult your intelligence. The build-up, you know, it doesn't make us all look like idiots for just doing the deliberate swerve.
Yeah.
So I like the sort of the intelligence to that build, if you like. And much like Kieran said and you've said, it's remarkable that they were able to do this during a period where they'd completely ballsed up Randy Orton's face turn, and it seemed like creative pretty much didn't know shit from apple butter.
Yeah. I was actually kind of quite bitter about this whole angle playing out, because the whole time I was just thinking, this should have been Orton. This should have been Orton. Yeah, Orton was the all-round like talent. Yeah, and it took me ages. It actually took me way past this build to actually buy into Batista. The contract signing in particular is fantastic, because I mean you got Teddy Long there, and you got the fabulous Eric Bischoff. And this is this weird thing with Eric Bischoff. They're trying to sell him on signing their contracts, and Bischoff completely outdoes Teddy Long. Surprise, surprise. Because you can see Triple H and Ric Flair going, no. They're just shaking their head, going, no, don't do it. As Bischoff's doing this amazing Paul Heyman sell to him, saying, look, think about it. You know, Batista versus Triple H at WrestleMania. And it's just all great, where, you know, it does the whole thumb thing, which harks back to when Triple H did the Caesar thumbs down on Randy Orton. He does it back to him. You know, the funny thing is, but as soon as they do the thumbs down, like, the camera immediately zooms in on Triple H. Triple H is doing, like playing, like, oh, I'm shocked. The camera needs to stay on Flair. Flair's face is fantastic, because he looks all straggly now. He looks like the old spinster woman in church that's just been told what a rim job is. He's just got like this absolute just shocked and appalled face, and then just Batista just absolutely destroys both of them. It's fucking fantastic, and it's only like now when I look retrospective back in it, I think, looking, judging by how Orton's career has gone, he's not the best baby face in the world. And so I'm thinking, even if he got this type of push, would he have worked as a babyface? Whilst Batista, with his limitations, did work as a babyface to a certain degree. He did have a lot of success as the babyface for quite a while. So maybe in the end, Batista was a better fit for this storyline than Randy Orton.
The one thing, what was really good, I think, to the casual fan, is although we all knew it was going to be Triple H Batista, there was enough suspension of disbelief for casual fans, because the Flair Triple H premise of go to SmackDown, win that title, and then Evolution will dominate the whole company. So there's enough there to, you know, will he, won't he?
Yeah.
It's casual fans, so when he turns, it's just that extra element to it.
Yo NM65 from F4W says, I enjoy anything with a pure sports build. Rock Brock at SummerSlam 2002 with the workout videos, or Bret Shawn at Mania 12 with the training reports with Jim Ross stand out to me. I dig this too. Rock Brock, I thought, was really well done. And it's not just the videos, but I mean, the videos were awesome, but just the whole aspect of, you know, Rock walking up the aisle after a promo, Brock comes out and doesn't even look at him and walks past him, just shit like that, the little touches, so good.
Me and Kieran were remarking about this one before we started recording, and my one abiding memory from that build-up actually is the complete sort of non-reaction from Brock, if you like, because he just strolls past Brock. It's the one thing that's sort of etched in my mind. But I did love the sports element in the build-up, and I remarked to Kieran at the time that even though I enjoyed that, I felt that that was a little bit underplayed in that feud. I thought they could have built that up more going into SummerSlam.
As we kind of touched on, we tend to take away with historic views in particular, take away what is memorable to us, and that it was just a nice element for Rock, because we've seen Rock grow up as this charismatic megastar, but he's like actual athletic pedigree has kind of always been underplayed. He's like he's a 6'5" beast, really.
Freak, yeah.
And he likes to play it up now because he'd been the action hero, but back then he wasn't really done. And once you give him the gimmick, he's a bit of a pussy, really.
Yeah.
You know? So run up the steps and, you know, trying to, wow, this is going to be an athletic contest. Maybe you can go toe to toe with this fucking rookie monster.
Colin Bollocks from the UK Fan Forum says Nexus was another summer feud that was great and fresh during the first month or two. Properly felt like Vince was on point during all of that until it eventually fell apart once more. The debut alone was incredible, but it kept escalating until that big face-off on Raw where the camera was shaking and it felt like the biggest match. So the pre-SummerSlam Nexus. There was the match on Raw where they were built to the 7 versus 7 match. They basically had the Nexus against 7 scrubs, pretty much. Like, decent mid-card folks. And the Nexus swept them. And it's like, that's ace. They just absolutely steamrolled them and made them look so dangerous. But obviously the build fell apart fairly quickly from there. Up to SummerSlam, I thought they did a pretty decent job.
Yeah, it was one of those times that we kind of get quite regularly over the recent years is, oh, a hot start. How are they going to go for this new direction? At least for like a month or so, it looked like they might. but as you say, let's not talk about SummerSlam.
Builds in WWE often do start phenomenally well, but do not last. And if it goes 3 weeks of good build these days, we are blown away. It's not just me, is it? I mean, I am legitimately surprised if we're 3 weeks in. It's like, holy shit, three episodes of Raw and they haven't fucked it up yet. Holy shit! Next week it's guaranteed to fuck up. I better watch that. But with Nexus and stuff, it's an example of something that is tainted by retrospect, which is such a pity. Because I can't watch that opening angle again, which was fantastic at the time. I can't watch that again without thinking, oh yeah, that's the bit that got Daniel Bryan fired. And I hate wasted potential, and I've said that so many times. I hate wasted potential. It's like, you know, a build for a person. Like when Lesnar came out and utterly destroyed Cena that time. And everyone was here, we all sat in the room. I was like, holy shit, where are they going to go from here? They can do anything. And that one was literally just an evening of enjoying this build, this new creation, something to see. And retrospect tends to taint these moments nowadays.
Nightro from WrestlingForum.com says, Stone Cold vs. Triple H from No Way Out 2001. The build-up was so intense you could feel the pure hatred leading up to their 2 out of 3 falls match at the pay-per-view. Triple H had Austin mowed down at Survivor Series, so Austin dropped Triple H in a car using a forklift the following year. Triple H cost Austin his WF title match with Angle on Raw, so Austin cost Triple H his match with Angle at the Rumble. Austin gave Stephanie a stunner on Raw, so Triple H pedigreed JR on SmackDown. It got so... his wife, I guess. It got so out of control between the two that Vince forced him to the contract signing, which included a no-touch clause before the match at No Way Out. And if Austin had touched Triple H, he'd have lost the WrestleMania title match. And if Triple H had touched Austin, he'd been suspended for 6 months. It was storytelling at its best and perfect in execution. The match did not disappoint either. The two looked like equals and badasses coming into their match at No Way Out. The build itself, where do you weigh on this? Because this is very much of this era, the let's blow each other up to build to the match.
Yeah, I mean, the being hit by a car, I can accept, because Austin isn't active on the roster for another 11 months. The dropping Triple H from the top of the forklift in a car and then he's back in 3 weeks, I take a bit of an issue with.
Yeah. Was it even that? Was it like 8 days?
Eight days?
It wasn't long.
It wasn't long enough is the crux of it anyway. So there are little bits there that I'm not so keen on in the sort of early build upon Austin's return. I do like the... When you get to the Rumble, and by the time Austin costs Triple H the world title match against Angle, and Triple H tries to cost Austin the Rumble in retaliation, that I think is fine, because it's more logical, it's more realistic in terms of a feud than using plant equipment. And I like the sort of the non-aggression pact. Where would I be without a war reference? The non-aggression pact.
Triple H puts one letter on the contract and gets the cheap shot employee signs. That's pretty good.
That's a great little stick. And the fact that the way in which they get around that by, obviously, they've signed the contract and you have Austin, Stun, Stephanie, and then Triple H, we say, pedigrees Austin's road wife Jim Ross. it works well, I think, once you get to sort of January and beyond. I think I do enjoy the build up, particularly, as I say, the element where they're not in contact with each other, that sort of that less is more, that you're waiting for the confrontation. It is always something that's, well, it's just completely lost in today's wrestling era. So there are bits I like about it. I think it takes a little bit of time to get going from my perspective, though.
Mufasa from the UK fan forum says, maybe not best ever, but I really enjoyed the build to Flair Savage from Mania 8. The doctored photos in the WWF magazine, first Flair with Liz, then being shown to have been Savage in the photos all along. I also remember Oakland visiting Flair on his yacht for more details of the affair. And another of Flair and Mr. Perfect having a picnic. I could be wrong, but Flair's sweater was a thing of beauty, second only to Jake's at Survivor Series 91. Playing a cassette of an Antiphone message from Liz, all building to the unveiling of the pictures on the big screen at Mania. Having Brain on commentary all the time to put it over was great. Also, the phrase, she's damaged goods, she was mine before she was yours, didn't go down too well with my sister. This was fun. I don't need to touch on this one too much because you pretty much hit all the bullet points there, but this is just, Flair was, this was classic Flair, probably the best of Flair during this WWF run, I feel.
Correct.
Alright, let's move along. Shishin KOPF from TPW Forum says, my favourite build to a match is a tie, either Edge Booker T at Mania 18 fighting over the Japanese shampoo, or Kane Jericho feuding over Jericho spilling hot coffee on Kane. Riveting stuff.
They're feuding over coffee!
The sign.
Classic.
there could be an entire show on worst builds, and I think those would be two strong candidates.
At least Jericho had that great line with Kane, though. Sorry, champ, hope that coffee didn't burn you.
Well, it didn't do it for me, Carl, so... LSF45 from WrestlingForum.com says, I freaking love the SummerSlam 98 build between Austin and Undertaker. Everything from the Highway to Hell commercials to the face versus face allure being used properly. It was the right match at the right time. Plus, after it was done, it was a perfect split into two different directions. And CD Player from WrestlingForum.com also agrees with this one. At the time, it seemed like the biggest confrontation since Andre and Hogan. Undertaker had never lost clean on television, and Austin had as much momentum as 80s Hogan. The unstoppable force meeting the immovable object. Russo was on his game for this storyline, teasing the Kane-Undertaker alliance for months going in, with both Taker and Kane impersonating each other on the way. This is one of the best chapters of the Kane-Undertaker saga as well. I will agree wholeheartedly. I love this build to SummerSlam 98. This actually is up there with one of my favourites. So I think this is just, again, that slow story of building to a big match, but I thought this was really, really good.
It is a good build. I particularly like the bit with Taker dressed up as Kane.
Yeah,
I think that's a great, like, with the reveal, and Austin's on commentary just sort of startled,
throws the headset off.
It all does build up nicely, and again, it's another one of those feuds where I think the music tie-in plays a significant part to it as well, with AC/DC.
It's a really good example of something that right from the off felt big.
Yeah,
and it's something that everyone wanted to see. There were kind of subplots in it, but the general through line was very clear, and it never lost that it's fucking coming, it's fucking happening feeling. And that was one of those of the, because I can't think of many others in that immediate era that really spiked me as much as that did, because I was a big Undertaker fan at the time. So yeah, it felt special, and it kept it special.
Yeah, cahoots, I tell you, cahoots.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I said before, I've never been a real massive Taker fan. He's never really floated my boat. But yeah, this did feel like a fucking huge match all the way going in. It did feel like a generally special big match. So yeah, completely agree.
Probably worth pointing out as well, we talk about the, again, going back to the sort of the modern era and the quick turnaround of things. I think it's what probably helps this in terms of making it feel important, even now in retrospect, is the fact that it's still during the, you know, during the sort of the TV wars era phase, and you've got the fact of a storyline which is starting in effectively.
Taker made the challenge that he wanted Austin before Over the Edge, I suppose.
Yeah, if you can even go back to Over the Edge, where Taker's the enforcer. Yeah, exactly. So,
and it's also a point of of some of the really great feuds, which is, at the end of the day, what's on the line is more about just who the hell is going to win.
Yeah.
Who is going to win? Who are they going... if you're, you know, if you're a smart bastard, you're thinking, who are they going to put over? But everyone else thinking, who is going to win? I legitimately don't know. I mean, who is the better man? And it's seldom that you really get that anymore. God, an example came to mind, and the worst thing, it was bloody Lesnar Goldberg at one point.
Which I thought was actually not a bad build.
No, the build, no, it's the match that was fucking awful, but the build actually was, the match was a social experiment. But the build is actually, if not, I would argue probably not that memorable, but it is really quality.
Yeah, good. It's a very good high point.
No, you're absolutely right, because it's the feud that has the prize fight feel to it.
A bit of a wacky one here for our final nomination. Not Jay Tab from Pro Wrestling, and he says, the build-up to the first Booker T Goldust tag title run. Just the way that Booker started out not liking Goldust, then accepting him, and finally becoming teammates is one thing, but I love the way that they properly built up sympathy for Goldust via his self-doubt of being the weak link of the team. All those bits with Booker refusing Goldust's offer to split the team before Goldust being the one to get the title-winning pin over Jericho and Christian was great.
I actually read this on the forums before the show, and it triggered so many memories I wasn't aware that I had. And not in one of those childhood trauma kind of ways. but it was great. And it was... It
Book
was
dust.
Yeah, and it was different. And it mattered in a weird way. And I've got a big... I'm a big mark for... I guess humble wrestlers for that whole Mick Foley, the way Mick Foley got himself over as a face, and the way Goldust in this completely changed the way he was being represented, and this self doubt and stuff, and really put it across. And I think it's something that I think the underdog culture and that whole side of things, and going with the sympathy can get you quite far. And I was a big mark for that whole storyline from people that I didn't really ever care about before. Yeah. But Goldust hadn't been relevant for how long before that, really?
Yeah. They brought him back and he tried to make him like a serious heel against Van Damme, and it just wasn't clicking. It's just like he became like the gimp outcast dressing up as like Darth Vader and Steve Irwin and doing those goofy skits, but it was really good every time. We've run through as many suggestions as we have time for today. Unfortunately, if we haven't got to yours, we apologise, but I would very quickly round the table like to ask personal favourite build up of all time. And I know I'm putting everybody on the spot here, but what are we saying?
Well, I'm going to go with the build up to Mick Foley and Randy Orton at Backlash 04.
Yeah, that's a very good
okay.
one.
And the reason why is, besides the fact that it's just some of Foley's best work, and it's what established Orton, it's the Royal Rumble 2.0, you know, basically. Yeah, kicks him down the stairs. Mick Foley ends up becoming a commissioner and puts himself in a match. And then in something that you're never going to see the likes of Hogan or Austin or Rock or John Cena and so on do, the babyface turns around and chickens out. He walks down to the ring, he circles around, everyone's begging for it. They hype it up like this is Foley's return, he hasn't wrestled in like 4 years. Randy Orton catches up with him, and Randy Orton was playing, this is when I loved Randy Orton at the time, I was completely behind him. He was playing this absolute douchebag, like almost like the rich kid. Like the rich kid who's getting everything, you can do whatever he wants because his dad, in this case Triple H, is running things around here. He's the boss, so he can do whatever he wants. He's got his little cronies in Ric Flair and Batista, and he's just a complete douche in this. And you know, once he figures out that Foley ain't gonna do anything, he spits in the guy's face and he just carries on walking past him. And that's something really daring that you're not gonna see another top babyface do. And it just kind of builds, and it builds and builds to eventually, you know, Royal Rumble, he helps, I think he eliminates Orton. WrestleMania's included in that, which at the time I remember being a little disappointed with, because I was hoping to see Cactus Jack 2000, and instead I got Mankind 99 in terms of performance. And I know, in retrospect now, when I watch it back, I don't think so badly of the match. I think it's quite fun. The key one being the promo, the Barbie promo.
Oh yeah, the rocking chair.
Yeah, where he's in the rocking chair, and as he's doing this, he's in the rocking chair, and the rocking chair's getting faster and faster. As you've just seen this, he's looking like he's an old crazy bastard, but he's looking like it's the old crazy bastard who's finding like cheesy line, finding the eye of the tiger, or whatever the wrestling equipment would be. You know, finding that spirit again, and until he pulls out Barbie, and it's just to the point where it's like finally, because I didn't want Mick Foley to fight Orton. I didn't want Mankind. I wanted Cactus fucking Jack to destroy this prick, even though I loved Randy Orton at the time. I wanted to see this guy get his comeuppance. And it, you know, it came about in a match which I hold in my top five, because it just made Orton.
Two words, Lex Express.
Oh, come on! You can't
be really?
As a mark, probably, yeah, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I'm wow. completely my type.
I'm ever going to look at you the same way again.
But realistically, Austin up to 14.
Yeah.
That was, yeah, I mean, that was, with Tyson, that was just so huge and so massive. It was, yeah, earth changing.
Glacier.
Punk Cena. Money in the Bank 2011.
Yeah,
I think that hasn't come up today, has it?
No, there was something you voted for, but we couldn't get to.
Yeah,
it.
No, I
do it now. What the hell?
PTO, oh, if you want, yeah.
PTO from FOW says Punk Cena at Money in the Bank. One of the last times I can remember a WWE title match where the outcome didn't feel predictable or irrelevant.
Agreed. It was something special in a time where there wasn't much special going on. Interestingly, a friend of the podcast, a gentleman named Alex Haydash, who was a friend of some of us on the podcast, occasional listener, he kind of stopped watching wrestling in about 2002, and he's recently just gone back and watched a bunch of Manias, and he's trying to get his head back to it, and he has no idea who CM Punk is. He stumbled upon a hype video for the match, which isn't one of the big hype videos I think that we remember. It's not a big...
Is this the do I have your attention now video?
Probably, yeah, yeah. I think so. And it's not one of the big musical videos we all sit back and think about, but yeah, the build for that match and the match itself. I mean, it had something to follow. It had something, which is very impressive when you consider it had people like John Laurinaitis as part of it, and yet it still mattered. but yeah, it's something that has stuck with me as showing what storytelling can do in wrestling, and we don't go in interesting directions like that enough anymore.
Yeah, I'm sticking with Glacier.
The blood does run cold.
My blood's running cold right now. Punk Cena was there's some great anticipation for that match and what was going to happen and where are they going to go. I'll go Austin Taker, actually, I think, from Highway to Hell. I thought that was a really great build. The whole Taker Kane Kahoot storyline was really good, and Austin Vince was there in the background the whole time, Vince pulling the strings, really good stuff. So I want to thank everybody for listening. We will be back next week for the next installment of the Monday Night War timeline. We're going to be tackling the second quarter of 1997 from April to the end of June. One I'm very, very excited to do, because and usually we would wait longer between timelines, but I cannot wait to get to this one. So for Kieran O'Rourke,
I'd just like to thank once again McNeely's Beard Oil for sponsoring me on today's show. I love it, my woman loves it. Avoid thigh shaving on those most intimate of moments. That's McNeely's Beard Oil. Thank you again.
For Carl Jones,
remember folks, it's never about Virgil.
For G. John Chase,
that's why Roger Podacta is dead. He found Captain Winky.
For Luke Edwards,
and remember to tune in after the show for that promised hype video. Let me tell you folks, it's going to be amazing.
I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.